Are there any pressing questions from yesterday? Okay, good. So yesterday we, you know, one of the things that we'll look at in more detail in today's tutorial is some examples of how to, you know, construct branch cuts for functions which are multivalued. So today's topic is very important, and I think that it's, although you've all kind of seen this before, it's important to actually refresh our memory about complex functions. So in general, a complex function is a map from some open set U. So you have some open set U. In the complex plane, and a complex function f is a map from U to, it can be C or it can be some subset of the complex plane. So there are many ways of defining complex functions. One is to be very explicit. So, for example, you can say, so I'm just not going to use the argument here that some power of, say, the complex variable Zn. Or you could have, you know, some function which is something like this. Which, so the definition could involve both the complex variable and its conjugate. These are just examples. Another way of defining complex function is to take well-known real functions and for example, a lot of real functions are defined in terms of their power series expansions. And to generalize that into a complex function. Yes?
Is that a contingent symbol after U on the first one?
Yeah. So. So when we define a complex function in terms of extending the domain of the validity of a real function, we always require that function to reduce to the real function when we specialize to the real line. Otherwise, it'll be just not a very, it'll be inconvenient. So we'll see more examples of this shortly. So you can think of a complex function in terms of two real functions which are functions of the real variable x and y. So here, the complex variable z has real part x and imaginary part y. And if I give an expression for a complex function in terms of z and z bar, you can just do an algebra and rewrite, okay, sorry, half the class is poured in. So you can always do this, right? I mean, this is, you know, although I'm not proving this, this is just algebra. Now, because the relationship between, you know, between the you know, z, z bar, and x and y are linear, we can think of complex functions as being functions of z and z bar. So we think of as functions of z and z bar. Although secretly we know that z and z bar are related by complex conjugation, but it is, yes? It's just an open subset of C. Yeah. So we can think of complex function as, you know, functions of z and z bar. So it's that, although we know, you know, secretly that z and z bar are essentially, you know, complex conjugate of each other. And we'll see why this is such a convenient thing to do. So when we do that there, you know, we see, you know, two different kinds of functions. So for example, we can have functions like this, which is, say, the real part of z. When we express it in terms of z and z bar, we get something like this. And then we have functions such as, which are defined entirely in terms of z. And if you expand the power series and everything, this these two power series, the power series expansion of the exponential function and the cosine function match with the usual definitions of the exponential function and the cosine function. Or you could use Euler's formula to show this. So this is an example of a function that we can think entirely in terms of z and not z bar. And we'll see that such functions are known as holomorphic functions, and they occupy a central place in complex analysis. I'm going to define this more rigorously later on today. So let's look at some examples of complex functions. Now consider the usual, you know, sine and cosine. And why are we spending so much time on this? And the similar expression for cosine. So the thing is that, you know, there are different ways of thinking of the sine function. You can think of it as defined on the circle. And you know that the circle, the unit circle, is the same as this set of points on the complex plane, right? So we could have said, okay, we could have taken theta to be here, but the way we think about a function when we are extending it to the complex plane is that we think of the function at first being defined on the real line and then extending it to the plane. So what we do here is that the sine of z is defined in such a way that when when we specialize to the value of, when we specialize to the real line, it gives us our the function that we are extending. So this is kind of a bit of a subtle point that, you know, we, even though you could have defined this function on the circle, you know, the definition that we are using is the one which is on the real line, okay? Because we think of the circle as this set of points on the complex plane, right? And of course, this, now, you know, you can ask what, how does this function behave on the imaginary axis? And this function has very different properties on the imaginary axis. You know, it's not periodic along the imaginary axis. So similarly, you know, we can define hyperbolic, sine hyperbolic, just by the same formula. So these guys are now periodic along the imaginary, you know, in the imaginary direction, right? This way of extending a function that we know on the real line to the complex plane is a special case of what is known as analytic extension. And the analytic extension of a holomorphic function gives us a unique function on the whole of the complex plane. And therefore, you know, there is some intimate connection between holomorphicity and analyticity and uniqueness. Okay. Life gets interesting when you consider inverse functions, as we saw yesterday. So, so the inverse function, you know, related to this is the square root of z. And we saw that it's to have a single valued function, we have to define it on a double sheeted Riemann surface. And similarly, to define the inverse of this, we defined log of z to be log of the modulus of z plus I times the argument of z. Now, argument is the, is a multivalued function, and it is infinitely multivalued, where k can take any integer value, and therefore to make log of z a single-valued function, we have to define it on an infinitely sheeted Riemann surface. And depending on the function, if you want to construct the Riemann surface, things can get pretty pretty involved. So in my notes, I give you the expression for a lot of the common inverse trigonometric functions. You know, that's, you can just look it up, and I'm sure you've seen some of it before. And I also give how to derive those functions. And unless somebody wants me to, I kind of don't really want to go through that. But let's just like look at the expression of one of those guys, say sine hyperbolic inverse of, well, let's take z. And ask ourselves, what are the branch structure of this function? So It's actually quite, it's, so there's a logarithm and we know that there probably is associated some infinite branch of it. And there is a square root, so there's a, there's probably some, you know, double sheeted Riemann surface there. And it turns out that, you know, if you look at the, like, the logarithm function had a branch point at the origin and a branch point at infinity. But if you look at the argument of this log function and say, when is it, you know, is it, when is it zero? It turns out it's never zero on the finite part of the complex plane. So unlike just a simple log function, sine hyperbolic inverse doesn't have a, like a branch point associated with a logarithmic, you know, behavior on the finite part of the complex plane. However, because there's a square root here, and you can, you know, write the square root as, there are two branch points at plus I and minus I. And so you have to, you know, connect them by a branch, sorry. And they're double, so to make them into, so when you construct the Riemann surface, you have to, you know, associate a double sheeted Riemann surface. For these branch points. So you have some I here and minus I here. And one thing you don't want to do is that you probably don't, you want to construct the branch cut such that, you know, it it goes along the imaginary axis. You could have done the branch cut along here too as well. But usually, you know, we don't do that because when you reduce this function to the real line, you know, we don't want any ambiguity about the function on the real line. And then if you think about this and, you know, do the variable transformation where, you know, z goes to 1 over t and rewrite this function as a function of t and ask yourself, you know, what happens as at t equals to zero, you realize that there is a logarithmic branch point at infinity. So there is an infinitely sheeted Riemann surface associated to that. And because there is a double sheet here, so the whole Riemann surface is doubly infinite. And it turns out that you might say, okay, in the case of the simple log function, the, you know, the branch cut went from zero to infinity. Here, you know, where does the branch cut, the logarithmic branch cut from infinity go to, right? And I actually didn't know the answer until yesterday. Does anyone know? It actually goes to infinity again, but on the other branch of the double-sheeted Riemann surface. So we can ponder about this more at the, in the tutorial today. Okay. All right. So I thought that, you know, this these sort of functions have an interesting branch structure. So now that we have introduced complex functions, we want to differentiate them and integrate them. And differentiation comes probably before integration, logically. I think logically they're independent, but you know, that's how we are taught, right? So so our next topic is complex differentiability. So now that we have generalized the idea of a function to complex variables as a holomorphic function, we want to, I actually haven't told you what a holomorphic function is, but I've told you how to analytically extend a function to the complex plane. Now let us also generalize the notion of differentiability. It turns out that the holomorphic functions will satisfy a generalized notion of differentiability that is stronger than the usual notion of differentiability in terms of the real components. So if we have some function, complex function, and we write it in terms of some real functions u and v. And we say that the function u is differentiable at a point. So we say that u is at a point x at the point x naught y naught if there, you know, there exists two numbers c and d such that CMD, let's use A and B. Sorry, two numbers A and B such that such that, you know, if the remainder function, I call it R, goes to zero rapidly as these two small numbers go to zero. Okay, let me state this again. So we said that u is differentiable at the point x naught and x naught y naught if there exist a and b such that in a neighborhood of, in a small neighborhood of the point x naught and y naught, we can write u in this way such that the remainder function goes to zero as these h and k go to zero. So h and k are telling you are basically parametrizing the small neighborhood. So it's kind of, it looks a little weird the way that we are defining this, because when you talk out partial derivatives, you usually divide by some small number, but that only kind of works if you're in one dimension, right? Because we're in two dimensions, that's why this is a better way of looking at it, right? Similarly, we can have, we say v is also differentiable at a point x naught and y naught if it satisfies the same requirements, but with different, in general, different constants c and d, and some other remainder function s, and I'm not going to write those conditions again, that the remainder function goes to zero rapidly as h and k goes to zero. But the point is, these constants a and b are what we identify as the partial derivative of the function. Right. So how do we, so now we generalize this to a, these conditions to a complex differentiability. So we say that the function f, which consists of u and v, has to satisfy, in addition to these conditions, the following condition. That if you, for a small omega in the neighborhood of the point z naught, where z naught is the same, the complex combination of x naught and y naught, there exists some number, complex number e, and some complex function omega, which is a, there's a typo in my notes. And so just explicitly write e as in terms of two real numbers, and omega in terms of our small quantities h and k. Then the remainder function goes to zero as omega goes to zero. So if this is satisfied, then we say that the function is complex differentiable at the point z naught. So we can ask ourselves, okay, what does this condition mean in terms of the real and imaginary part of the function f? In particular, you know, what does it mean for those partial derivatives of u and v? So if you write out the real and imaginary part of the, that condition, you get this guy. So there's an x, y naught plus k. So far, so good. But now you see h alpha minus k of beta plus the real part of sigma. And for v, h of beta plus k of alpha plus the real, the imaginary part of sigma. So these two constants, alpha and beta, occur in both of these expressions. Right. So now, now, comparing these guys to our relationships, to this relationship and that relationship, you know, for everything to be consistent, it must be true that alpha is du by dx at point x naught. I'm just not going to write x naught and y naught 1,000 times, as well as dv by dy, and beta is equal to minus du by dy and dv by dx. So what has happened is that by imposing complex differentiability, we have been able to relate the different derivatives to each other. A priori, the different partial derivatives of the real and the imaginary part of our function didn't have anything to do with each other, right? But imposing complex differentiability connects them, that the that these conditions must be satisfied for our function to be complex differentiable. So these equations are at the heart of complex analysis, and these equations are called the Cauchy Riemann equations or conditions. Okay. And if the function f satisfies if f is real differentiable, and it satisfies the Cauchy Riemann, we say that. So at some point, you know, at some point z, then f is called analytic at that point. Okay. Hello. Different books will use slightly different terminology for this, but I think analytic is if the function satisfied Cauchy-Riemann condition at a certain point. Now, if the function is complex differentiable in an open set, then it's called holomorphic in that open set. Okay, so if f is, analytic in some open set U, then f is called holomorphic. Okay. Being a physicist, I only understand mathematics in terms of physics, in physics language. And so in some sense, I think of the differentiable properties of holomorphic function as giving you a coordinate invariant version of differentiability. And to see this, I'll give you a kind of an artificial example, but it's still valid. So suppose we consider a function which is zero at the origin, but at every other point on the complex plane, it's given by this expression. Now, you can show that for this function, the x and the y derivative exists everywhere. And, at all points other than the origin, you have to use this expression. But in the origin, you have to actually use the definition of partial derivative. it's actually the partial derivatives of f vanishes at the origin. It's kind of cooked up in such a way. Now, but if you approach the origin in any direction other than x and y, then the partial derivatives don't exist. And to see this, you can, if you just express this function in polar coordinates, then, you know, this guy just becomes sine of 2 theta by 2, right? And if you plot sine of 2 theta by 2, then this guy is zero along the x. This is the positive x-axis, and this is the negative x-axis. This is the positive y-axis, then this is the negative y-axis. So it's only zero along the x and y-axis, so that when you approach the origin in those direction, you match this value. But if you approach it in any other direction, this function is not zero at the origin, and therefore, you know, it is not differentiable at the origin in any other direction. It's kind of an artificial example, but it kind of gets the point across. But if we now consider a complex, differentiable function, that is a function that is real differentiable as well as, you know, complex differentiable, then that function, if its partial derivative will exist at a point no matter how you approach that point. So I think there's putting a complex structure on a function defined on a two-dimensional plane marries those two different, you know, direction, or makes them unified. Okay, so now how to spot a complex function? Did you guys go to your nature walk, or was it canceled due to rain? Oh, okay. Sorry? Oh, sorry. Otherwise, you could have spotted some complex functions in the nature. Sorry, that's a bad joke. So let me give you an example of a few functions. Where x and y are real. Okay, so which of these functions are holomorphic? Can someone tell me? The fourth one, okay. So how did you spot this? Right, exactly. So that's an easy way to spot holomorphic function, because if you, if you use that our definition of what z and z bar are, and then you can work out using the chain rule, you express your partial derivative with respect to z and z bar, and here, of course, we are treating z and z bar to be independent variable. Then these are the expressions you get. And then you can take your Cauchy-Riemann equation and rewrite the partial derivatives in terms of z partial derivatives with respect to z and z bar, and then you get two equations, and you realize if you combine them, if you add them with an I, you basically get one complex equation, which is right. Okay, let me go to the other board. So in other words, a holomorphic function is only a function of Z and not Z bar. Like the old Star Trek episode from the 60s, where Kirk is magically transported, well, transporter accident, you know, takes him to this parallel universe where everybody's evil, like Spock carries a knife. And, you know, and the way to get the captainship of the Enterprise is to actually kill your superior officer. Every holomorphic function has an anti-holomorphic function as well, right? So you just replace all the Zs by Z bar. So right. So holomorphic functions are only, you know, a function of Z. There's a lot of beautiful geometry hidden in holomorphic functions. And let's unlock that. First of all, you can think, because F has a real and imaginary part, you can think of those guys as being the two components of a vector. So you can say, let's define a vector T . There's a minus sign is just for convenience there. Then it turns out that the Cauchy-Riemann equations, imply that the divergence of T is zero and the curl of T is zero, the two-dimensional divergence and curl. If you didn't want this minus here, then you have to flip U and V, and then these two equations would kind of flip. So that's kind of cute. Now, you can think of these functions U and V as providing some sort of curvilinear coordinate system locally on your complex plane. And therefore, you can ask, you know, how does the gradient of U and the gradient of V behave? So these are vector fields. And again, by a very elementary computation, you can show that they are always at orthogonal to each other, using the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And not only that, the rate at which they change, let's not use the mod for vectors. So this is the mod squared of the vector field. Again, by using the Cauchy-Riemann equation, you find that the rate of change of these guys is the same, these two different vector fields. Okay. These properties are very important for what's coming next, which is conformal maps or holomorphic maps. So this is kind of the bread and butter of two-dimensional conformal field theory. And string theory has very important applications in string theory as well. So what do I mean by conformal maps? So suppose omega is a complex variable. So omega is a complex variable. And that Z of omega is a holomorphic function of omega. And we have f, which is a holomorphic function of z. So now what we can do is that we can compose these functions. So we can write f of z as f of z of omega. And we can compose this function, and now we can express this as a function of omega, which will be a different function, right? The functional form of g on omega will be in general different from the functional form of f on dependence of f on z, right? So now because both f of z and g of omega are holomorphic functions, therefore their real and imaginary parts satisfy, you know, those relationship, the, you know, the, that I wrote up there, that the relation where the gradient of the real and imaginary part are always at 90 degrees with each other, and that, you know, their rate of change are the same. Rates of change are the same. So if I express f as small u and small v, and g as big U and big V, and okay, let me just be more careful here. Because u is a function of x and y, v is a function of x and y, and g is a function of big U, big x and y, and big V, big x and y. So the same equations, you know, are satisfied by u and v. So in other words, a holomorphic change of variables lead us to, So if we have two curves on a given complex, you know, plane, then if you make a holomorphic transformation, then those curves will be then mapped to new curves on your new complex plane defined by this holomorphic function, which is itself a coordinate on a new complex plane. But the angle between the two curves will remain invariant. So locally, you know, that those two, you know, the angle between the U's and V's are remaining invariant whether you are in your original plane or the new G plane. And so this is basically what is known as a conformal transformation. A conformal transformation takes an infinitesimally small triangle and maps it onto another small, similar triangle onto this new plane. And it's not always the case this happens. There are times when this will break down, and we'll see how it breaks down in tomorrow's tutorial. So, you know, we'll do some more detailed calculations about the about conformal transformations using the complex plane. Okay, so the last bit of geometry associated with complex function, holomorphic function, are harmonic functions. So let me remind you what a harmonic function is. A harmonic function is a function that is a solution to Laplace's equation. In two dimensions, this is this guy. So again, if you have a if you have a holomorphic function, you can show that its real part and its imaginary part will satisfy Laplace's equation, and therefore they're harmonic functions. But you can turn this thing around. If you are given a harmonic function, you can always use the Cauchy-Riemann equations and integrate them, and then construct a function v, which will be its conjugate. It's it's harmonic conjugate. And therefore, if I give you just a harmonic function, you can construct a v, which is the harmonic conjugate, by using Cauchy-Riemann equation, and then you can construct this holomorphic function f out of it. And once you have a holomorphic function, you can come up with any holomorphic map you can imagine, some arbitrary function of z, just don't include z bar. Then you have a new holomorphic function, and then you can look at its real and imaginary part, and they will be guaranteed to be harmonic functions. So this is an extremely powerful tool, a tool that is used in many branches of physics. I think, you know, people doing, you know, there's important applications in aerodynamics, for example, and things like that. So unfortunately, we don't live in two dimensions. Otherwise, you know, a lot of physics would be solved by this, by conformal transformations, right? Also, if we lived in two dimensions, we'll probably not have brains. So brains require three dimensions to work. So in my notes, there's an example about how to construct the harmonic conjugate if you're given a U. I'm not going to go through this. The calculation is elementary because I'm kind of rapidly running out of time, and I'd like to go over to integrations of complex functions. But before I go, are there any questions? Everybody's like, we are just checking the news. okay. So in talking about integration of complex functions, you know, we'll consider what could be called a line integral, but in the business it's called a contour integral. It just sounds more cool. So a contour integral is basically you have some holomorphic function f of z, and you want to integrate it over some curve gamma, so where gamma is a curve that doesn't intersect itself, and such a curve is called a simple curve or a Jordan curve. So we define these integrals in the following way, because I really haven't told you how to even think of these guys, right? Because so far, all we know is how to do integration on real variables. So first, let, you know, gamma is, let gamma be a smooth, piecewise smooth curve. So it's maps from some interval A to B to some open, you know, set in the complex plane. So essentially the picture I have here is you have some curve, and the curve is parametrized by some number, A to B. So A and B are real numbers. So as you go along the curve, you know, A monotonically increases or decreases to B. That's what I mean. A and B are not coordinates of your complex plane, okay? It can be there's a distance, right? But so this is what we mean by a curve, right? A curve parameterized by some parameter. So we can explicitly write the parameter as t. So t goes from A to B. T is a real number. And then this object is defined. So this is a definition to be the integral of the function f evaluated along the curve. So this function now has a real part and an imaginary part times the derivative of that curve along that path times dt. So this is the definition of a contour integral. This kind of looks like, this bit looks like if we have used some kind of chain rule. We haven't. This is how we are defining it. The way this is defined, and you can check this, is that if you reparametrize your curve, so you introduce some function s, which is a monotonic function, monotonically increasing or decreasing function of t. So now s is your new parameter on your curve. Then this definition is invariant under this reparametrization. Okay? And you have to use a chain rule to show that. Okay, let's do an example. And it turns out the simplest example is also the most important, or one of the simplest in terms of applications. So we're going to consider a holomorphic function, integral of a holomorphic function on a circle. Right. So we want to integrate a holomorphic function, and we choose our function to be some power of z raised to some integer n, and the integer can be negative. And we want to integrate it over some circle of radius r, and a popular parametrization of this circle is given by this. So our contour integral is then given by, okay, so it's Zn d of z. And then we use the definition. And the definition, because we chose this parametrization, the circle, the t goes from 0 to 2 pi. And our function is r to the power n e to the power int. And then we take the derivative of this guy with respect to t. So we get an I coming down from the exponential. The R does nothing. And we have e to the power I of t times d of t. And then this is an integral on t, so we can just factor out the i's, r's, and so we get this very simple integral. Now you know that the exponential function, the cosine and the sine function integrated over 0 to 2 pi will give you 0. So the real and the imaginary part of this guy will give you 0 unless n plus 1 is 0. In that case, you just get 2 pi. So the result of this calculation is that it's 2 pi I if n is minus 1, 0 otherwise. So this is kind of a very useful result, as we shall see soon. So now we have learned how to do differentiation, complex differentiation. We have learned how to do integration. And now we have to somehow connect those two things. And that's done through the fundamental theorem of calculus. So the fundamental theorem of calculus as applied to complex variable goes as follows. So suppose you have an U, which is an open set of C, and let gamma be a contour in that, let's take it to be in U. And let F be a function from, let F be a continuous and suppose there exist, and suppose there exists another function f from, defined in U such that the derivative of f gives you our original function. So f is in some sense the antiderivative. Then the fundamental theorem of calculus as applied to holomorphic functions is given by now, in this example, we took A and B, the two endpoints of our curve, of our contour, to be the same point. But we found that in the case, in the special case when our integrand was 1 over z, this is 2 pi I, which is not equal to 0. So if f is continuous in that region, then of course, if you take A and B to be the same point, that should give you 0. So this means that the f associated with this integrand is not continuous. Of course, we know it's not continuous because it's just log of z, which is multivalued on C. So everything is consistent. So the next very important thing to discuss is Cauchy's theorem, Cauchy's theorem is like, you know, like, I don't know, the sun in the sky of complex variables. That a good analogy? Yeah, sure. Why not? And I'm going to just prove a weaker version of Cauchy's theorem. To prove the stronger version of Cauchy's theorem would take me a whole class, and you know, this class is not really about proving, but to just give you a flavor of things. And the version of Cauchy's theorem that I'm going to prove will assume that given a holomorphic function f, its first derivative exists. It turns out that the Cauchy's theorem implies that a stronger version of Cauchy's theorem implies that all the derivatives of a holomorphic function exist. So that's why we are doing a weaker version of Cauchy's theorem. And to do that, I'm going to use two-dimensional Stokes' theorem. Again, I'm cheating. I'm not proving two-dimensional Stokes' theorem. Two-dimensional Stokes' theorem is also known as Green's theorem. So let A be a two-dimensional vector field. So A is a 2D vector field with continuous first derivative. In some region D, which is simply connected. So simply connected means that D doesn't have any holes in it. So give me an example of a simply connected, non-simply connected space. Sorry? A point, right. Or a pizza with a hole in it, right. So mathematicians call, the way of saying is that the fundamental, I think the fundamental group, pi 1 of D, is the identity group. That's the technical definition, but anyway, that doesn't matter. Then Stokes' theorem. So okay, by this I mean a line integral that is taken on a loop. So okay, let gamma be the loop that is the boundary of the region D. So this is by this I mean the boundary of the region. So if this is D, gamma is this thing. Then the line integral of A is given by the surface integral of curl of A through. Okay, so this is Stokes' theorem. Now, if I write it out in components, then we have ax d of x plus ay d of y is given by d of ay d of x minus d of ax d of y. Dx and dy, right? So this is Stokes' theorem. Up you go, Stokes. And then now we can apply the Stokes' theorem, Stokes theorem or the Stokes theorem. Apparently Stoke was, is this Stoke or Stokes? Stokes, yes. The Stokes theorem. So Stokes was a lecturer or a professor or whatever, Don at Cambridge. And after he had discovered the theorem, he had set it as a tripos problem before publishing it. And apparently one of his students got it. His name was James Clerk Maxwell. So. It could be just another piece of apocrypha. So we now consider f of z, d of z, and now we write out everything explicitly in terms of real variables, u plus I of v, dx plus I of dy, and then we just collect the x and y bits. So this is the a component, so this is the x component of our vector. And this is the y component of our vector. And they apply the Stokes theorem to it. And there's an IU minus V. So this is the curl. Okay. And then we can just rewrite this. Okay, I'm just going to write this over there. We can express this as I times d of dx plus I d of dy, so a differential operator acting on our function u plus iv dx dy. And then recall, although I didn't write it explicitly, but the partial derivative with respect to x and y are related to that of the partial derivative of z bar in this way. So this can be written as 2 times I d of f of z d of z bar dx dy. And therefore, if f of z is holomorphic, this is 0. And so we have shown that if u is, for a simply connected region, if there's a closed loop gamma in that region, then the contour integral of a holomorphic function on that closed loop is 0. Right. So this is the Cauchy's theorem. And I think I'm going to stop there today so that you can have a little bit of a break before Aggie's class. But any questions? The orientability of D. Yes, I mean, I think, okay, as far as I know, if you have a, I don't know the exact answer, but for a two-dimensional manifold to be a complex manifold, And you know, you have to, the original two-dimensional manifold have to be an orientable manifold. So I think that, you know, probably it'll be very hard for you to define a holomorphic function on a non-orientable manifold globally, you know. So doing an analytic continuation there, you might run into problems. So interesting questions. I don't exactly know the answer, but that's my hunch.
In case that one over z, like we do not get the integral equal to zero, and
right.
Like I always use that like equation as without a stop. But if so, should we like extend our domain into the Riemann surface again? I mean, like all
well,
the
no.
zero is really.
You mean well, one over z is not a. It doesn't have a branch point. It just had a pole. So you can't extend it. I mean, you extend the domain when you have a branch point, not a pole. So. Okay. Anything else? All right, time for some caffeine.